census numbers are out today. We're so money and we don't even know it.
And new rules of the road for the internet. Who gets to stay in the fast lane?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, the 21st day of December. Coming up, a new program that helps companies figure out their water risk. And for the first time, advertisers spend more online than in print.
But first, the government released the first results of the 2010 census today. There's a whole lot of politics involved in the process of counting people. In the end, how many people there are in a certain place equates to how many dollars that place gets from the federal government. Marketplace's Eve Troe has more.
Census population numbers are a strong economic indicator. Since 2000, the U.S. grew close to 10%. There are now about 309 million Americans. The census shows the South and West grew the most, as has been the case for a while. Robert Inman at the Wharton School of Business says, nationally, that makes sense.
Having people move from one state to another is going to improve economic performance because people will get a better match to their job opportunities.
But that means the Northeast and Midwest lost some people. Only four states actually lost more people than they gained, Michigan the most. Robert Inman says that's a major economic hit.
As you lose people, you lose tax base, but there typically will remain fixed costs and still have their roads to maintain, still have their sewer systems to maintain, still have a police force to maintain.
Government aid is determined by population, so fewer people also means fewer federal dollars for maintaining those systems. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is set to approve so-called net neutrality rules today. Now, those rules will help the FCC ensure internet users get equal access to bandwidth. Whether web surfers visit a major site, say Amazon.com, or something a little more specialized, say frogscelebratingchristmas.com, which I don't think is a real site, Stacey, but Cecilia Kong.
It should be.
It should be. I'm saying. Cecilia Kong covers technology for The Washington Post. She's with us now to talk about it. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi.
When we say net neutrality, what are we talking about? Where does net neutrality come from?
It's basically the very fundamental idea that you as a consumer should be able to get anything you want on the web that's legal. So if you want to get a Google search, a Facebook update, if you want to make a Skype call, you should be able to access those websites and those services unimpeded. They shouldn't be faster or slower. They shouldn't be fast lane, slow lanes, more expensive or less expensive ways to get that kind of content. That at the most basic level is what net neutrality, the idea is.
And what does the FCC have to say about net neutrality?
Well, this is really sort of a historic moment, Steve. The FCC, for the first time, will vote for regulation that makes sure that companies that bring internet lines into your homes, like Verizon Communications, AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, do not pick and choose what you get on the internet. But there's another question about wireless networks, which isn't as covered as strongly by these rules.
What's the reaction been, Cecilia, so far from all these companies, from Comcast and the big cable companies, the big wireless companies?
So the companies that provide you access to the internet, they just don't like it. They don't like the idea of regulations, but the FCC's rules are sort of a compromise between lots of negotiations. Web companies like Google and Facebook, they also support it with sort of tepid support as well. So the FCC is introducing rules that are supposed to be sort of down the middle, but at the same time, and what they've managed to do is not get a lot of support either.
And how is the FCC going to enforce these rules, Cecilia?
Now that the rules are in place, the idea is if you are a startup, you know, if you're in that proverbial garage and you see an internet access company blocking you, you have a mechanism now to go to a federal government authority and say, look, this company is violating rules.
Cecilia Kong is tech reporter for The Washington Post. Cecilia, thanks.
You bet.
Regulators are reportedly considering making financial firms pay executives partly in stock and other deferred compensation. It's supposed to give executives a stake in the long-term health of a company. Here to talk more about this with us is Julie Niemann, an analyst with Smith, Moore & Company in St. Louis. She joins us live. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Stacey.
Julie, how likely is the government to step in and regulate executive bank pay?
Well, they did it somewhat during the big banking crisis. The Fed basically stepped in and the Treasury stepped in an attempt to claw back, especially when you had executives who were fudging the numbers. But the new Graham-Frank bill really is not going to give that much control to corporations over what you kind of executive pay you're going to have. The biggest problem is there's really no rhyme or reason on how these bonuses are paid. It supposedly is for the long-term health of the corporation, but there's been absolutely no correlation with that. So basically what it is it's a disadvantage to shareholders, and the question is, are you really getting good bang for the buck here? And there's no evidence that bonuses really do that.
And bonuses are supposed to be up this year, is that right?
Right. They're looking on average about 5%, you know, so everybody is getting significantly larger bonuses. A few of the larger corporations like Goldman Sachs has tied it to stock options. But stock options intrinsically are hugely disadvantaged to the shareholders because they're basically diluting everything that the shareholders have. And there's really no evidence that compensates executives any better or any worse than just plain old cash.
What would be a good way to regulate bonuses, or is there a good way?
Well, there is, and one of the easiest ways is to get more shareholder influence on the board of directors. They're usually the board of cronies, and they just put in anything that you want the existing management to have. Have them represent shareholders more and get more outside influence, and that means independent outside ones. The other easy one is to not allow corporations to deduct them from their taxable income. As soon as you take that away, it becomes less of an incentive in terms of a lot of bonuses are paid depending upon how much a company makes. Well, that would lower how much a company makes because bonuses, especially in the case of some that happened in the middle of the financial crisis, were 86% of all the TARP money.
Julie Niemann with Smithmore & Company in St. Louis. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 21st. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
It's cold and snowy in parts of Europe and many parts of the continent. There are fears the icy weather could plunge the whole British economy into a deep freeze. Airlines and rail companies have been the most visible casualties, but many other companies have also been. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from the snowbound London Bureau right now. Good morning, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
How hard is this storm hitting Europe's already pretty weak economy?
Well, the UK economy is what we've got a figure for, $1.5 billion a day, according to a big insurance company here. Businesses like bars, restaurants and entertainment venues have taken quite a hit. Shops and retail chains are suffering very badly, too. Some of them usually make as much as a third of their annual profits at this time of year. And online retailers are reporting problems, too, because they're having to put off customers by saying, because of the travel chaos, we can't guarantee you'll get your goods delivered before Christmas.
And snow has been reported everywhere in or it seems like everywhere anywhere in Europe, but it seems like the problems are worse there in the UK.
Britain is less prepared because usually it has milder winters than continental Europe. But also, in this more American-style economy, many companies here have cut their costs more and reduced their ability to respond. Here's James Krask of accountants PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Businesses have spent a lot of money on driving efficiency through organisations. And in working those efficiency through the organisations, they have cut out resilience.
The very cold weather is forecast to last beyond Christmas.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
This year, for the first time, advertisers spent more money on online ads than on print ads. Online ad spending was up about 14% to more than $25 billion. Here to talk about this with us is Andrew Frank with Gartner Research's media team. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
How significant is this?
Well, I think it's something that a lot of analysts, myself included, have been predicting would happen for a long time. So in some ways, it's no surprise. But in other ways, it is something of a milestone in the evolution of media.
A lot of retailers and companies not that long ago were very uncomfortable with online ads, or at least the price structure was very unclear. Has that changed recently?
Well, there's been a lot of innovation, as everyone knows, in the way that ads are sold and priced and generally done online. But I think that there's still some confusion and lack of clarity on the local level as to what the best way to advertise online is. And maybe there's an opportunity for the news organizations going forward to help some of those local merchants get a better result from their online advertising.
How big is online advertising right now relative to other media?
Well, it's still down in the 10-15% of media spending overall. But I think to put it in perspective, television is still, you know, more than twice as much spending going on that medium.
And finally, what does this mean for print advertising?
I think that the bright spots on the horizon have to do with making a better connection between the offline world and the online world. Get people from the print medium into something electronic where they can get more information, get some sort of promotion, and redeem it in the store. So I think that the best thing that print can do is think about how they can exploit their connections with the local community and also create less of a boundary between ads that you see in print and the ads that you see online or on mobile devices.
Andrew Frank is Research Vice President with Gartner Research's media team. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Japanese carmaker Toyota has agreed to pay fines topping $30 million for failing to inform regulators of its sticky gas pedals. Hans Greimel is Asia editor for Automotive News. He says Toyota keeps hoping the issue's been resolved, but it won't be for a long time.
It would seem that they were already kind of over the hump and that they were trying to, you know, had kind of put this behind them. But the agreement of these new fines kind of puts it back into the headlines and makes the recalls and their safety record brings it back under public scrutiny.
All told, Toyota's paid out almost $50 million in fines this year.
Merriam-Webster's just released its list of words of the year. Terms that got big searches at the dictionary publisher's website.
All right, so some of the top words here, Stacey, socialism.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay. All well, right. Another one is doppelganger, your lookalike. These days, they mean on Facebook.
Number one, according to Merriam-Webster's, their word of the year, austerity.
Okay. Well, you know, austerity is a big word these days.
It is, as in bare bones, as in the national budget's cut to the max to avoid economic disaster. Who are we thinking of? Greece and...
You're always thinking of Greece,
yes,
Steve.
That's the homeland. And Ireland, of course.
Yes. And Portugal now.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 21st. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For the latest look at the markets, go to thenumbers@marketplace.org. If you're driving home for the holidays, the ethanol industry wants more of its corn-based fuel mixed into your gasoline. And the EPA this fall said, okay. But wait. Yesterday, the corporate interests that stand to lose filed a lawsuit to halt everything. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports from Washington.
The EPA rule under fire allows gasoline with more ethanol stirred in, 15% instead of 10. Automakers are suing on grounds that ethanol burns hotter and thus could damage car innards. Gloria Berquist speaks for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers.
Ethanol does tend to be more corrosive, so there need to be some changes made to the vehicles to take greater blends.
Blends that have not been tested enough, say the automakers. Also pouting are the oil refiners. The EPA rule squeezes their main product, says Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners.
Any barrel of ethanol that comes in crowds out a barrel of gasoline and weakens the refiner's margin.
Ethanol makers say the winners are agricultural jobs and that their fuel is renewable, though detractors say processing ethanol emits more greenhouse gases than burning gasoline. As for the EPA rule, some analysts predict a beltway compromise, where those of us in the real world end up pumping gas with about 12% ethanol mixed in. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The United Nations says over the next decade, water demand on the planet will exceed supply by hundreds of trillions of gallons. That's going to have a profound effect on people and on business. So the World Resources Institute, along with GE and Goldman Sachs, is coming out with a way to measure water risk for companies and for investors. Jeff Fulgham is Chief Sustainability Officer for GE Water and Process Technologies. He's with us now. Welcome to Marketplace.
Good morning, Steve.
What kind of information would go into this so-called water index?
What we look at is water risk across the board, and it's the physical risks of enough water available to run your operation or to meet the needs of the population. There's water quality risks, regulatory risks, financial risks to your operation. So what we do is take into account all of these broad factors and try to bring those all together to determine what is the risk in a given geography.
Why haven't we done this before?
Well, up until recently, water has been pretty much ignored. And I think what's happening over the last decade or so, we're reaching the point where the demand for water is exceeding the supply. And so it's really finally raising into the public's consciousness.
So how might water risk play out for a company?
So, for instance, a beverage manufacturer that might have 1,000 plants around the world wouldn't necessarily have water risk issues at every one of those sites. But if you're going to site a new soft drink plant in the north of China, major water risk there. There isn't enough water, so severe water scarcity issues. And the quality of the water that is available is pretty tough shape.
You know, Goldman Sachs is one of the partners in this endeavor. It's a really big bank, made a lot of money during the financial crisis. Does that, you think, diminish the credibility here that maybe, I don't know, greed could get in the way?
I certainly hope not. I think Goldman has been a big supporter from the beginning. So I hope that that is not looked at as a greed or any other motivator other than to try to better understand what are the risks in a given geography of an investment in that area.
Well, their objective is to make some money too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you budget for this? I mean, companies are already trying to climb out of a great recession. I mean, wouldn't this just add new costs?
Well, yes and no. The good news is that for many companies that are proactive around managing their water risk, it actually has a pretty strong payback. You know, we truly believe that green is green. Doing the right thing for the environment also provides a strong economic return.
Jeff Foljam over at GE Water and Process Technologies. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And finally, a new survey from Diet Detective ranked airline meals in terms of nutrition. United Airlines topped the charts with offerings like fruit and yogurt. Mm. The lowest score went to U.S. Airways with its French toast snack boxes.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Really, though, I mean, I sort of thought most airline food was pretty low calorie because, you know, usually there's actually not any airline food anymore.
Zero goose egg.
Yeah, I know. It's a... Just the soda, I guess. That's all there is left. That's all we've got left. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.